Tonight's talk is called Mood and Mindfulness. Mood and Mindfulness. And to me, in my experience of my own practice and the practice of others, including many of you, mood and attitude are these hidden aspects of mindfulness that really affect how our mindfulness works in daily life. Because this is something that we often fail to notice. We're not mindful of the mood or the attitude of our experience. And I'll take you through this whole process where we look at this in the course of this time. And then I want to take some questions and comments about this tonight. So the definition of the mindfulness that I want to use tonight, which is a little different than one that I've often used, is I am defining mindfulness as being conscious of what's occurring in the present moment, without being drawn away from it by aversion, desire, or disassociation. That is, we are able to stay in the moment. So it's not just being in the moment, but we're able to stay long enough to know the moment in some way. Because we're not, our aversion to it, or our desire to have more of it, or to protect it or something, doesn't pull us away, that we can actually stay in this moment, and then this moment. So we're not anticipating and getting a little ahead of the moment or coming a little behind. We're like coming in on the beat. We're in this moment, here, now. It's got this immediate kind of feeling to it. And and it's not like there's not aversion or there's not desire or not disassociation for reasons of trauma or uncomfortable with how we're behaving or whatever it may be, but that we are able to stay present long enough to recognize what's present. So if you're hearing a sound, you know hearing, but you also know that you're present long enough to know that it's unpleasant or pleasant. You notice that you're leaving your body. You're able to notice that there's some disassociation of some kind going on. But that's the way I'm using this for tonight for this purpose, because we'll see how attitude and mood fit into this. So mindfulness provides many benefits. First of all, when you're mindful, you know what's true right now. You know what's happening. That's a real benefit. Likewise, you're present for it. So not only is this happening, but you're present, so that you get to participate in it. If we're not mindful, something can be going on and we just completely miss it. Just completely. And you go, well, that seems unlikely. But really? How many times have we been uncomfortable in our lives and not known it till afterwards? How many times have we been kind of frozen around something? How many times has our speech not been how we would have it be, but we didn't realize it till afterwards? So knowing what's happening and being present for it so that we can adjust it in some way. And with training, mindfulness brings also this experience of a felt sense, feeling, in body, in heart, and in the head center even. And when I say with training, it takes cultivation to notice the felt sense. First of all, we need a degree of body awareness. That's why I did the particular meditation tonight, is that I was building towards this of the felt sense, just to feel the body in the moment in this way. And because if to some degree it has to become habitual for us to be aware of the body, to be aware of felt sense, so that we're not being, maybe we're not trying to be mindful, we're just walking down the street, but we're feeling our body walking down the street. We're not just planning or looking around and just seeing. So there's a felt sense. If we're planning, we know the felt sense of planning. Oh, when I plan, there's a little leaning in it, or there's this kind of building myself up as I'm planning. I get energized from planning. Or I'm seeing, and oh, my body, there's actually in my mouth or somewhere in my body just seeing things, seeing a pretty person or a handsome person, or seeing a beautiful tree with just as the last leaves are on it. So there's a felt sense of that sensation of seeing. It's a felt sense. The degree that we can do that is so much more than most of us realize, because we haven't cultivated it. It takes a lot of practice, but the more we practice the felt sense in ever wider areas, the more we have access to this, till the point it becomes a natural part of being in the moment. If we're mindful, the felt sense is there. As a matter of fact, the felt sense will be there even if we're not mindful. If we suddenly become mindful, we drop into the felt sense of that moment. And that feels very wholeheartedness, that dropping into that felt sense of the moment. It's, wow, I'm alive, I'm awake. Very strong feeling. So in developing the felt sense, we have to have this experience of the body. We also have to have a wisdom in knowing how to relate to the felt sense. So that wisdom allows us to know that we're present in the felt sense way, because we're mindful of our felt sense, and that sense of aliveness. And then to use that for wise reflection, we start to trust the felt sense as a little signal. So that, because when we try to figure everything out, like what's really going on to that investigation, we can really be in deep trouble by the time we get to that. But the felt sense, oh, I know this felt sense, this is trouble. We wake up right away to that, and we can start to adjust that. This, by the way, is not something that takes forever to start to see is true. Just a few weeks of playing with this, and you'll go, oh, I know exactly what he means. It's very susceptible to investigation. And with that sense of, oops, this is wholesome or this is unwholesome, we kind of know how to relate to it from the felt sense. And we see how, from just this felt sense, how it ties into our larger experience that's happening. And through the felt sense, we can develop compassion for ourselves. So some of you have physical pain, some of you have energetic experiences, some of you have emotional disorientation that happens to you. That felt sense of that, when you just see it in that's raw, terms of the felt experience, compassion comes much more naturally. You don't have to think, oh, that guy, I can't remember his name, but that teacher on Sunday was talking about being compassionate. You just felt like, ouch. And the compassion comes because when we stay with the felt sense, it's a natural response of the heart. And then in the felt sense, you can feel, in the felt sense, can also be used for wisdom in terms of knowing what really matters. Oh, this feels good, but it doesn't feel right. You know that feeling? Like continuing to eat feels good, but it doesn't feel right. Drinking, when you should stop having any kind of alcohol, may feel good that next drink. At the moment, it feels good, although it is so diminished in real life. If you watch it closely, its values. Maybe the first had that much pleasure, now you're down to this much pleasure. But nonetheless, you're able to see what matters to you because the felt sense. I know what feels true to me, wholesome to me, and what doesn't. And so we have more choice. Not perfect choice, but more choice than we do otherwise. So mindfulness, it brings the felt sense. We have to start with the mindfulness to recognize the felt sense. So mindfulness that knows what's happening, mindfulness being present for it with the felt sense, mindfulness that allows you to fully receive the moment. The Venerable Sumedho refers to it as standing under the moment. Standing under it. Standing under it as it's showering down on us as moments arising. And we're able to stand under it, particularly to stand under it in a way that we can see what's suffering in the moment and what's not suffering in the moment. And being able to stand with the suffering, with the stress, the discomfort, the unreliability in a way that brings wisdom. Because we can stay with what the Buddha calls dukkha, this disinterest, this stressfulness, this unsatisfactoriness. Through this mindfulness, this particularly the felt sense of it, we go, this is dukkha. There's dukkha in this. I can feel the dukkha in this. No. No. And we back ourselves out of it as best we can from wherever we are in it. And again, this is something that's very reliable. You can quickly catch on to it. Not hard to understand. And this phrase that the Venerable Sumedho uses, this moment is like this, or it's like this, knee pain is like this, being lonely at a party is like this, feeling like nobody in the room knows us or we're not welcome feels like this, feeling part of feels like this, feeling helpful feels like this. Goes back to that felt sense of it that I talked about earlier. And so the stand under has that felt sense quality to it. I use that phrase for myself fairly frequently around difficult things in my life. I've had a couple of extended difficult experiences, you know, reoccurring experiences in this last year. I talked about one other in relation to all the physical pain I had. And I found choosing to stand under it, so that I was making a choice. No, I wish to stand under this. I wish to know it completely. Very, very helpful. And the same with emotional discomfort. Just to stand under it. Not to like go into fixing it or how this isn't fair, this isn't right, but to stand under. To just be with it. Not to give up, not to become passive. Quite the opposite. When there is something that can be done, you're more likely to do it if you can be present for it in the first place and do it effectively. So the standing under. And mindfulness also provides the benefit of allowing us to investigate what's true in the moment. Investigate what's the cause of how I'm feeling right now. What role my conditioning and what role, so my own conditions and the conditions around me are contributing to this moment in such a way that I don't get deluded into some story about the moment rather than just treating it as conditions. And mindfulness in investigation allows us to see our own role in what's happening right now, ways we're being positive, contributing to our sense of well-being, in ways we're contributing to our sense of non-well-being. These both become available. So mindfulness also allows the development of equanimity. And this equanimity, in turn, allows for the three other Brahma-viharas, the heavenly abodes of mind, to arise. So with equanimity, there's room for the naturalness of loving-kindness, which is evergreen, it's always there. But if there's not equanimity, we can get so lost in the reactive mind, we don't have access to it. And in the same way, the compassion needs equanimity because it either scares us or we get pulled into it. And so equanimity allows us to stay in the middle so that that's this quality of mind that is so beautiful that's called compassion, karuna and pali, is available to us. I always need this equanimity for it. And the same with spontaneous joy when we see someone's happiness, that we don't fall into envy and we don't fall into disinterest. We stay in the middle because of equanimity. We don't, that the charge of another person's happiness does not pull us off center because of equanimity. And this equanimity is arising through the mindfulness, without being mindful, it's very hard to know, to stay. We don't even realize we're under pressure. And then in time, equanimity too becomes a habit of mind. One of the things in this last year, I was quite struck by how continuous my equanimity was around these two difficult things that were occurring throughout the year. I wasn't trying to be equanimous. I didn't think, oh, I should be equanimous. It wasn't like that. It was that it had become so trained in me through practice. That was just the attitude. The attitude was there prior to the discomfort, the disquiet, and it stayed there. And then when that abated, it continued on. The equanimity becoming ever more a part of moment-to-moment beingness. And this is true for us all. And a number of you in this room have developed quite a bit of equanimity yourself. So you know what I'm referring to here. Mindfulness also allows us to distinguish between the reactive mind that's reacting to pleasant and unpleasant and the responsive mind that's reacting from our values. When something's arising in this moment, we can be reactive to it. Oh, I want this, or I don't want that, that's not right. Or responsiveness. Oh, this is how I care about this. This is how I want to give witness to this. This is how I wish to relate to this. Regardless of outcome, this is how I wish to relate to it. So many benefits from mindfulness. It's so empowering. It's so useful. It so brings with it a clear mind. But we'll see in a moment, this thing about attitude and mood can inhibit all of our mindfulness so that we don't really use it to have a clear mind. There's other things also that can inhibit us having a clear mind, and I'll do that in another talk in here sometime. This has come up to me recently because I've had to make various decisions about people and performing various tasks. And when I'm in that kind of a role, one of the things I have to consider is, does this person have a clear mind or not have a clear mind? And sometimes people have a lot of practice, but their mind is just not that clear for various reasons. And one of those reasons can be that the mindfulness is too clouded over. That they're not, the mindfulness isn't really a full flowering of mindfulness. So, as I've named all of these advantages of mindfulness, from the felt sense to the compassion and so forth, this is the mindfulness of the Buddha. Samasati, wise mindfulness. The mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, that is the fourth noble truth of the Four Noble Truths. It is not mindfulness that is being alert to what's advantageous for us. It is not mindfulness that's seeking gain. It's mindfulness that's seeking wisdom, the wisdom to choose non-suffering over suffering, the wisdom that allows us to have access to compassion, to metta, to our equanimity. So it's the mindfulness of the Buddha. It's part of the Eightfold Path, along with concentration-wise, understanding-wise, intention, and so forth. So this is the mindfulness of which I'm speaking. Mindfulness, now I'm switching. That was like if there was a Roman numeral number one, we're now going to Roman numeral number two. And I'm being more analytical now. And mindfulness is object-oriented. It's being mindful of something. And this being mindful in this way means that we're mindful of the object of our experience. I'm being mindful of my body. I'm being mindful of pain. I'm being mindful of pleasure. I'm being mindful of speaking. I'm being mindful of my actions. I'm being mindful of hearing, of smelling, of tasting, of thinking. All of the sense gates, there's mindfulness at every sense gate. So there's a kind of, the mindfulness is there. So this object of experience, object is a word that's cold, object of experience. You know, my warmth towards you, that doesn't sound like an object. I wouldn't want to call it an object. And indeed, we would not in relating to it in a certain way, but in terms of the mindfulness, that is the word we have that is used today. It's an object of experience. My warmth towards you is an object of experience that I'm having in this moment. And if you can feel it, it's an object of experience you're having. It's an object, it's a phenomenon. No, I don't want to use that word phenomena. It's a
focus.
Yeah, but it's not the focus seen, it's the focused on. And the Buddhist language is much more the verbing than it is the nouning of things. So this makes it very confusing when we translate this to Western language. So this object, the reason it's valuable, the reason I'm asking us to focus on this here for a minute or two, the object of experience means that it is, when we take out our personal relationship to it, it is objective. Sadness, seeing, hearing, it's objective. It's just a registering of a sense gate being known, being cognized. So there's cognizing, mindfulness is cognizing, and the object is what is cognized. Okay? And that has a lot of implications. Because if that's what mindfulness is doing, we want to make sure that we're not leaving anything out by getting so focused on the object. Because we can narrow in like this in daily life in a way that may not be as useful as when we're sitting on a retreat. Because when we're sitting on a retreat, we don't have anything else happening. And so the next moment's going to be there for us to be mindful of that moment, the next moment, the next moment. But in daily life, you know, we start talking or we have to start writing or typing or something. And we want to maybe develop a broad perspective, a broad awareness to the arising objects experience in this moment. And that's what started this whole talk for me, as I've been mulling on this all week long. And so when we're being mindful of this experience in the mind, it's an object of experience in the mind that may be coming from the body, from eyes, ears, taste, all these different ways. And so we're interested in its effect on the mind, body, and the heart. So something's being touched. We wouldn't know it if this wasn't happening. So we want to sort of have a global view of how this moment's affecting us. And this global view will come back to attitude and mood in a moment. And then likewise, and it moves out of the moment here, but we want to see what's being associated and what's this moment's arising is creating associated thinking. This moment's arising is creating some sort of reaction, one way or the other. It may be a reactive or a responsive, but it's causing there's a responding thing. We're engaged in that object. We're having a relationship, sometimes quite an intimate relationship with something that may be not that intimate to us ordinarily, but in the way we're experiencing at that moment, it's quite intimate, and that intimacy can actually be pulling us off in a way that is not so great for us. So we are the culmination of that is we know through samasati, through wise mindfulness, that we're cultivating mindfulness so to have a wise response to objects of experience. We know what we're about. We have to respond in some way. We have to do some sort of, if our toe is hurting, we have to have some sort of thing about it. We ignore the toe, or we move the toe to see if we can relieve it, or we make a doctor's appointment because the toe's hurting all the time. We've got some involvement with the object of experience, but we are also looking at it from what is a wise response in this very moment. So my toe hurting and not kick it because it's hurting is not a wise response. When I was in college, I got so mad. I had waited forever to have a car, and I finally had enough money to have an automobile. And it's funny, I haven't talked about this in here ever, but I loved my automobile. There were various problems. For instance, the back windows were electric windows, and they wouldn't go down, but I didn't have enough money to get them fixed. And so one time, after having, towards my end of my senior year, I got the car in my junior year, and someone came to me, because I've been sort of like a force on campus and all this, and so everybody assumed everything I did was very deliberate because I'd been very controversial and all this. And someone came to me and said, you know, Philip, I just want to ask you something I've wondered about for a year. I said, sure. And he said, why do you think it's cool to keep your back windows up? And it was, that was their, they made up a story, you see, around this experience. I was quite cheerful to tell them that it's because I don't have the money. It's being willing to be with the truth of what's my situation. I don't have the money to get it fixed. So then one time, I was always having trouble with this car. And one time it did something. I can't remember what I was doing that time. And I actually bumped it against something. I mean, I just, like the wall or the thing in front of whatever it was, because I was so frustrated. I immediately knew that was not a wise response. So the role of the wisdom is in terms of the wise response right now, as well as like figuring out what to do. We're very, we naturally want to figure out how to win, how to get things fixed, so this kind of getting conditions as we want them to be, we make a priority. But without deliberateness, we will not necessarily make a priority having this moment be as we would choose to meet it. We just don't make it a priority. We don't think about it. And in part, it's because of this thing of mood and attitude, as we will see. So, since it's object-oriented, we're cognizing things. And as in doing this, I'm hearing a sound. I'm hearing a sound like the wind blowing through the door. That was a sound when we were sitting. I wanted to say, well, imagine that it's a flute. Someone's learning how to play the flute. Or imagine that it's a cry to us all, wake up, oh, yeah. So it's an object. And then, so we're aware of that, the wind blowing through the door. But we're also interested in how it's registering for us. And is it registering as pleasant or unpleasant? Is it registering as some call to action? How's it registering for us? And then, of course, the reaction or the responsive mind, but also the attitude. What is the attitude that's present, that's meeting this moment? What's the mood that's present in this moment? And that we forget. Sometimes, maybe you've never even heard the attitude or mood mentioned in a talk, I don't know. And this, because we're focused on the object, in the Upandita style of labeling, lifting or seeing or tying a shoe, moving, whatever, if you were tying your shoelaces, tying or moving hands, whatever, however you're registering it, it's just a label. that can leave out a lot of the experience. Yes, there is just the tying of the shoe, but there's a lot else going on in that very moment. A lot going on. And the part of it that we're looking at, of that other going on, is this mood and attitude. So I would suggest to you that attitude and mood may be an unrecognized part of your experience of being in the moment. So you see someone that you like, and you know you like them, but in this moment there's not much warmth. But you know you like them, and you smile at them and all this, but there's not that feeling, that felt sense of your liking. You could be tired or something like this. But maybe one way to look at it is, oh, there's a mood or an attitude I have in this moment. And that mood or attitude is affecting my access to my own feeling state. Because I really like this person. But there's no juice in my life liking this person right now. You following me? Mm-hmm. So often that has to do with attitude or a mood. So with attitude and mood can create the situation where the very same experience is seen or interpreted differently. The very same experience. You like the person just the same this much this time as this next time. Yeah, all things should be the same, but they're not. And that's because of the attitude or the mood we're in at this time. So I looked up attitude in the dictionary, and it started out with talking about the attitude of a body in art, or the attitude, the form, the shape of something like this. And then it went to a position or bearing as indicating action, feeling, or mood. So the position of the body. Again, I pointed you to the body for all this reason tonight in the meditation. It's an indication of action or feeling or mood. And then the big part of that, B versus A, B part of that definition was mood alone. That attitude refers to mood alone. So mood and attitude in this sense being interchangeable as synonyms. I'm going to make a little further refinement of that. And attitude is also defined as a behavior representation of feeling or conviction. It's a disposition that is primarily grounded in affect or emotion. Grounded in affect or emotion. It's attitude. It's something's got our emotions stirred up, and there's some affect, there's something that's going on with us that's really defining this moment more than what the object that's arising. That the affect or the mood is actually more primary than what we're experiencing in our narrative of, okay, now I'm petting my dog, now I'm getting in the car. That the feeling of our responsiveness versus reactiveness is being more defined by the mood than the object. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. That's not clear. Okay. So, people will say sometimes to me in distress about the way they are responding to a child. For children of any age, all sorts of different situations. I've heard many, many stories about how they're responding to a child, their child. And one of the things I will look for, they will talk about a certain behavior. And I will say, well, so when does that behavior happen? Does it happen all the time? Well, no, it doesn't happen all the time. Well, so when does it happen? Then I will ask, and what I'm looking for is what attitude or what mood are they in when that happens? So They are looking at the object, which they think they're being unskillful, but they're missing the fact that it was all set up by this attitude or mood. And helplessness being one, this comes up a lot with parents of someone that's a child that's got challenges of one kind or another. And so that helplessness can really overwhelm their response in the moment. And then they can get to believing what's being, they can believe that it's true, but what's really just an attitude or a mood that's defining the moment. Not too long ago, this came up with someone. Another definition of attitude is a persistent disposition to act either positively or negatively towards someone, or a group, or an object, or a situation, or a value. So there's a predisposition to act. There's an attitude that's there before we've actually encountered this situation. And what I would add to that is that that predisposition can change, so that you can have this story about, I don't like that person, but you're really in a good mood, and that time, you know, well, that person's not so bad. Or you're feeling so much pain in yourself, or you've been humiliated by a situation, and you know you've had this judgmental attitude towards this person forever, but feeling so bad about yourself right now, that attitude towards that person isn't there, because you're just, it's like you've been stripped bare of your attitude. Do you see what I mean? The reason I'm taking this apart in this way is because we can think our attitudes are more fixed than they are. Attitudes and mood are actually reasonably subject to our being mindful of them, including them and then working with them. Reasonably so. Over time, dramatically so, but reasonably so in the short term, in any given moment. We can go, oh, no, this is, I can feel my attitude here. I'm not buying all of these. I'm feeling all of this. I'm not buying any of it. I'm having all these thoughts. I'm not buying any of these thoughts. This is my attitude. This is my mood. No. In the Buddhist mythology, I see you, Mara. Then I looked up mood and to see what the dictionary said, and it says mood is the conscious subjective state of mind, a predominantly emotional or feeling. It's a prevailing attitude, thus mood and attitude the same thing, a prevailing attitude, general spirit or disposition. And then it goes on and said, mood is the comprehensive term for any state of mind in which one's emotion or desire or set of them is ascendant, stressing or pervasive or compelling. That it's stressed, it's compelling. The mood compels us. So at times maybe we like our kitchen cabinets, but we're in a certain mood and I can't stand that kitchen cabinet. It's ugly. Or it just doesn't work well, or I wish I'd never painted the inside of it because that smell of the paint, or whatever. We can totally contract into our relationship with the kitchen cabinet. You know, what are we investing in that? You know, and it's all being motivated by this mood, this attitude, and if we're just aware of the kitchen cabinet. And we're not saying, well, what's the conditions under which this moment of mindfulness is occurring? We miss something important. So a series of things for you to think about in terms of being mindful of attitude or mood in daily life, because on Sunday evenings the focus is on the Dharma in daily life. One is recognizing our ongoing flow state of mood and attitude. So throughout the rest of the evening, just be aware of your attitude, of your mood. Just be aware of it. Get used to tuning back in so that it's kind of something you're aware of, like you're aware of, you know, that you've got on a shirt or don't have on a shirt or something. It becomes a natural part of what you cognize in the moment. And you can see, I say flow state because the mood is so changing. And a lot of times, not always, sometimes we really get caught in a mood and it will not easily leave us. But then to be aware when the mood changes. Because lots of times mood changes all at once, or it starts building like a high pressure system in the atmosphere, and you can feel your mood getting sour. And once we see, oh, the mood's getting sour, we've already developed that objective relationship to it, where we're not being defined in the same way. This mood is now developing. Conditions are such, just like with the weather, that a mood is developing. This is a familiar mood. Oh, this mood's not so familiar. I don't know what's going on here. Whatever's the case. So we're aware of it, the ongoing flow state of moods and attitudes, and abruptly changing. And then we're very interested in terms of what is noticed in a situation. So back to the kitchen cabinets. They're slightly off in their proportions. Ordinarily, you don't